This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin, and with me, Brian Fernandez, and the morning run begins. It's the 3rd of November, because the penultimate month of the year. An exciting prospect. We have Christmas coming up next month and the new year, and of course 2018, something to look forward to. Don't you think, Brian?
Well, yes, I'm looking forward to the end of the year. That's when I normally take my vacation. So yeah, definitely. Tail end of the year, but it's amazing how fast the year has just gone by.
Are you planning to go to Egypt by any chance?
No, but there's interesting things developing in Egypt, right?
Of course, an Egyptian TV presenter has been sentenced to 3 years in jail after she discussed ways of becoming pregnant outside of conventional marriage, outside of marriage, I think. And it's really strange because clearly, you know, human biology does not require marriage, as such. It's just a social convention. But because she mentioned it, she's now going to spend 3 years in jail.
I feel sorry for her, really. Unfortunately, I think somehow the censors sort of slipped through the cracks.
Well, I don't think the censors let her slip through the cracks. In fact, they didn't. They didn't. And they caught her, actually.
Within the TV station itself.
Japanese and French scientists have made an announcement, and this is, of course, this is also a news item coming out of Egypt. There appears to be a giant void within the Khufu monument in Egypt, one of the big pyramids. This, because for anybody who's beyond, you know, the ordinary Egyptologist, it would be even regular folk for whom the pyramids have always held certain mystery
and fascination. Yes, and the thing is, the challenge is you can't go and hack stuff today, which is what they did initially when they wanted to discover the chambers. It's a very delicate process. They've just got to measure stuff. They've got to do intricate boring. So it'll be interesting to see how they actually finally tunnel through.
Yeah. So this void there, I think there's a void in Egyptian society, clearly, that would put somebody, a journalist, in jail for 3 years just because she mentions the facts of life. Talking about a void, perhaps, you know, in the world where everybody seems to be deeply unhappy about something, one of the sources of unhappiness, of course, is the inequality between different groups of people. One of the major ones, of course, in contemporary world is the gap between men and women in terms of wages and social conditions, in terms of opportunities. But according to the World Economic Forum, though, despite everything that's been done, the gap between men and women is going to take at least 100 years to close at the current rate of progress.
And also, so what's fascinating is Malaysia, which is not in the forefront of gender equality and so forth. In our budget this year, we've got a couple of initiatives to really help to bridge that gap, one of which is, for example, that 30% of all boardrooms really have to be composed of women in terms of the directorships in public companies. Good step forward for Malaysia.
So if you want to scream out, you can always tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Remember, progress for women and the closing of the gender inequality gap is going to take at least 100 years. So not within your lifetime. The lifetime of your children or even maybe just about their grandchildren, I think. Also, a quick note coming through Asia. Charles and Camilla touched down in Malaysia and Donald Trump is set to visit Asia for the first time. Japan, South Korea, China, Vietnam and the Philippines are his pit stops. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Breakfast in America by Supertramp. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Brian Fernandez, and the morning run continues. Time to talk about hair, which you have an abundant amount.
I wouldn't say abundant amount.
I think so. I think it's it's creditable for a man of your age, and you know, and because I think represent male pattern balding in all its glory. But we're talking about a younger set of people and hair, and this because this is a story about a 4-year-old boy who was sent home from a play school because his hair was too long. And the school said they must follow rules. The mother said, what has this got to do with getting an education? And I think that's been the long-standing conundrum. Why do schools impose these rather archaic notions of discipline, and hair length, when it's got nothing to do with education.
Well, the thing is, yes, it seems archaic. It's something that's a product from our generation, perhaps, you know, from 20 years ago of going, or 30 years ago of going to school. But the reality is, let's look at current situation in militaries, for example. In order to impose discipline, they all have to get their haircuts. It's conformity with...
Yeah, but the haircut doesn't bring discipline. That's by being disciplined, you follow the rules without thinking. And that's discipline.
Yeah,
but... Right, so you got it the other way around.
No, but the thing is, Sharad, it's all part of the whole equation in terms of that process of discipline. So hair is just one component of it within the school system.
Well, you know, so it's one of those things, and it was an item in the newspaper just a couple of days ago when somebody from the ministry, I think it perhaps came out in Parliament, saying that a 1976 circular issued by the Ministry of Education on the length of boys' hair in schools still stands. 1976 is, you know, a good, 40 years ago, 41 years ago now. And because, you know, shaped our time. But I think we have to go back to the lament of this mother. This is not a Malaysian mother. This is an American mother who says, well, still, what has this got to do with education? So if education, you know, if the idea is that discipline is essential to education, and discipline is defined as not questioning rules that are set up by those in authority, then you have a really interesting tension between this idea of, you know, not questioning and the idea of education, which is really about questioning. It's about thinking creatively. It is about opening your minds and going beyond the borders that are set for you.
Yeah, so this is where my personal... feelings come into play, because I believe that actually they should let people come in yellow-coloured hair or orange hair or whatever to school, because we need to have freedom of expression. Now, I'm a believer of uniforms, because one of the things with uniforms in terms of conformity is really that if you come from different socio-economic groups...
Let's pretend everybody's equal then.
Yeah, we need to, because you see the thing...
Why do we need to pretend that everybody's equal and people are not?
You see, Sharad, here's the thing. If you go to a school where there are very rich kids and very poor kids, now there's always going to be this oh, I've got a better clothes than you have.
And oh, yeah, so because... But I've turned up in the same shirt that you wear, but I come in a Bentley and your father brought you on a motorcycle. And so that makes it okay then, right?
But at least, you see,
it's tokenism. Helps. No, you're arguing for tokenism.
Better than nothing, Sharad.
Really?
Yes, absolutely.
No, what about embracing the fact that people are different and we live in a world that's unequal, and we should do something about changing that rather than indulge in tokenism that changes nothing?
No, but Sharad, at the end of the day, these are young minds. You need
to shape... Yeah, so you shape them by forcing conformity on them. How deadening is that for creativity?
No, in terms of the uniform, I think... You've got to narrow that.
You can't have it both. You can't have it both ways, Brian. You can't say you're all for creativity at the same time extol the virtues of conformity.
Go back
to
junior college that I went to. I mean, we went to the same junior college, different times. There were very, very rich kids.
Just a couple of years between us.
Yeah,
just a couple of
very,
years.
Very, very rich kids who walked to school and sometimes came in Rolls Royces because that was the neighborhood. There were also very poor kids who were children of factory workers and so forth. The commonality there was grades. And many of those kids, I think, would have felt differently if, for example, you were allowed to wear a Rolex watch to school.
If you think that young people don't know that somebody is richer than them and that the world is unfair and unequal and that the rich kids are always going to be able to parlay their resources and privileges into something better with more opportunities than the poor kids have, I think you're sadly mistaken. That's very naive.
No, I think that especially in a school system, for example, that allows you to succeed based on meritocracy. So you go into better schools because you've got good grades. That helps you in terms of social mobility. So the poor kid doesn't feel inferior. The poor kid sees that, okay, I'm in a good school. I study hard. I can get ahead as well.
Clearly, you weren't a poor kid. Okay, if you want to join this conversation, you can always tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Next up, we continue the discussion about education. We look at technical studies versus liberal arts. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that's Blondie and The Tide Is High, a number from 1980 when I was not quite a spring chicken. I mean, I was in secondary school and you weren't quite in secondary school, were
not,
you, Brian?
Not quite.
No, okay. That's Brian Fernandez. I'm Sharad Kutin. And the morning run continues. It's coming up to 19 minutes past six. It's the 3rd of November. And time to continue our discussion about education, because education is a favorite topic of the Malaysian chattering classes, I think it's safe to say. The question it has arisen now that we've seen the success of Silicon Valley about the value of a liberal arts education. For the longest time, it was thought it had no place in a place like Silicon Valley, that the geeks and those with technical knowledge were the only ones who are really going to flourish in a place like Silicon Valley. Now there's thinking that in fact the fuzzy heads, the liberal arts, those who studied the humanities, actually have a place in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, so that condescending attitude that techies often had, and I remember this when I was in school, you know, some of the engineering or computer science students would look at people doing humanities and say, "Ah, you're doing some Mickey Mouse courses." So, but I think in the Silicon Valley as well, that, as you said, particularly among the venture capital class and the engineering people, basically said, yeah, okay, you know, it's less robust and you don't get that sort of hard-nosed mathematics and engineering.
But it's robust in a different way, right? It's robust in an analytical sense, meaning that the kinds of questions that people who have a strong foundation in the humanities and the liberal arts can ask might border on the philosophical, they might have to do with human motivations. They set up the possibilities of taking the technology further. After all, technology is there to answer human needs. And human needs are a slightly amorphous and difficult thing to pin down.
So this is what the crux of the article, and that is correct, the evolution of the thinking. So while initially the thinking was, the hard subjects were the only way to go, today even engineers themselves, and the article references that, realize that they need to balance their hard engineering skills with soft skills that come out of a liberal arts education. So you find that from 2010 onwards, you've seen this flood or increased numbers of people who are from a liberal arts background joining Silicon Valley companies and contributing in meaningful ways.
I mean, maybe it's part of the problem is in the language you use to describe education. So we talk about the hard sciences, we talk about soft skills, and presumably hard is better than soft, and all those terms that are related in that way, the kind of binary thinking that's imposed on us by industry, by government, by our parents, about what's good and bad. And so instead of reaching for a balance, instead of getting all-rounded people, we've created people that are very one-dimensional in their approach to life.
And that's really had an impact in the workspace. So I've worked in a couple of tech companies in the past, and always the challenge is the technical people talking to the non-technical people. It's almost as if, and someone like me often ended up being the interface, because tech spoke a different language, sales, for example, spoke a different language, and never the twain would meet.
What did you do? Did you do a liberal arts course?
So I did an economics degree, so I was a business guy. So I didn't do a lot of hard sciences, but I did a couple of liberal arts courses, which were not audited, so not stuff that I sat for exams.
So you audited the classes, but you didn't actually sit for an exam.
So I've sat for classes like drama, ritual, and magic, and Asia's mythical religions. Not for an exam, but I actually went for all the classes and didn't go for my economics classes.
So, you know, it goes back to the way in which parents today are shaping the choices of their children. I mean, young people trying to decide what's good for them as they approach university or higher education usually rely on their parents or their peers or what is said about what will be a good course to do. And often it's about perceptions about salaries and job opportunities. Yeah.
That's how I chose my university degree. My parents gave me the freedom to do it. I chose a degree that could get me a job.
And but what about aptitude? What about vocation? What about matching the kinds of knowledge that you're going to be imbibing as and your personality? Well, what about that kind of mix?
And also, given the increased mechanization, artificial intelligence and robotics that are coming into the market, which will displace a lot of jobs, I think the jobs for the future, really, if you really want to be relevant as a young person moving forward, you really need to be a hybrid person. You've got to have some technical skills as well as a liberal arts background.
Okay, if you have an opinion on this issue, you can always tweet us at BFM Radio, WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Taking us all the way up to the first bulletin of the day, we have Fleetwood Mac and Dreams. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Valerie by the late, great Amy Winehouse. I'm Sharad Kutan, with me, Brian Fernandez. Now, at a DAP dinner in Seremban on October 28th, Chief Minister of Penang, Lim Guan Eng, said many announcements for the Chinese community in Budget 2018 came to nothing, and he pointed the finger at the MCA. Now, he was quoted in a Chinese daily that if he had met Liao Tiong Lai, in the corridors of Parliament after the tabling of budget, he would have offered him a wheelchair or crutches to help him through the last mile. Now, later, Guan Eng told reporters that he only was targeting Liao, not disabled people, because what's happened is that that statement that he made and was reported to have made has come back to haunt him, in that he's been accused by the MCA chief of insulting disabled people. Now,
but surely, Sharad, he was just mentioning it figuratively.
Yeah, and so this is the conundrum, right? When politicians use language like that, are they in danger of being accused of not just targeting individuals that they say they intend to target, but also disparaging a community or a group, or in this case, the disabled, unintentionally? And even if it's unintentional, does it still make it any less bad?
Yeah, well, in this case, obviously, it's been taken because for purely for political reasons, it's been taken out of context and blown out of proportion.
I mean, what's interesting is that the Star newspaper runs a story with the headline, "Cruel and Lame," in quotes, joke backfires on Guan Eng. But the word lame itself is a play on words, is a reference to disability. So then can one accuse the Star then of also disparaging, disabled people? Well, the newspaper itself has used the language it makes reference, because we know the expression "a lame joke," which means a joke that's failed, it hasn't worked as a joke, it's not particularly funny. Here you have something of a headline that kind of, uses that.
So if you use the same standards, then the Star should be lamented for it.
Yeah. So okay. So then, what standards should we use? Should we, especially those in public life, be given some sort of leeway, allowance? Should we, as a society, be more mature and say, the way we use language, it there's a figurative or idiomatic dimension to it. For instance, we can say, that somebody is blind, which is not a reference to whether they're visually impaired or not, but it's just that they're unable to see something that might be apparent, or they're,
And we use that expression so often, and no one generally questions it. That's why this whole exercise is a political motive to get for some people to get mileage out of it.
Yeah, okay. So we put aside the intentions of the MCA chief, right? The question really is, do politicians have to be extra sensitive? I mean, do politicians, just to safeguard their own interests, should they be very cautious about the language they use?
They absolutely have to, because essentially, it's just like us on air. We've got to be careful about what we say and do on air, because basically it could be easily taken out of context. What the politician says in private He's probably a little bit more free to express himself.
Yeah,
or
this,
herself.
Yeah, this seems to be, I think, the burden of public life, that you really have to be on your guard 24/7 and saying it was just a joke, I didn't actually mean it that way. Actually, it's just damage control after, you know, the problem has already been sort of set off by something that you said, maybe in complete innocence or as a jest. We'll be back with more, this time on the minimum wage. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was The Doors with People Are Strange. Brian Fernandez and myself, Sharad Kutin, talking about people and how strange they are. Politics makes for a range of strange comments and behavior, but we won't get into that. We'll get into something very specific, and this has to do with the minimum wage, something because of great concern to a lot of Malaysians who are struggling with the cost of living. Now, the Human Resources Deputy Minister, Ismail Muttalib, has accused the federal opposition of being fickle on the issue of minimum wage. He said the proposal by Pakatan Harapan to have a higher minimum wage at 1,500 ringgit monthly is not feasible. According to Ismail, employers will not be able to manage their operational costs, and as a result, some operations might and factories might close down. So he's saying that there's a spectre of job losses arising from an unrealistic target for minimum wage. We spoke to Firdaus Rosli, Director of Economics, Trade and Regional Integration from ISIS Malaysia, and we asked him why setting a number on minimum wage is difficult, especially when it appears that everyone has an idea of what they think the minimum wage should be.
There'll be serious repercussions if we don't get it right the first time as far as revision of minimum wage is concerned. I think any revision in this case, any revision upwards, is not going to mean that if we get it wrong, we can revise it downwards. Because once such revision is done, it will affect many other areas in the almost an instant. Because prices will go up, you know, wages will go up as well. And then if we think that this is not in the interest of the economy, then any revision downwards, which is it's going to be very tedious to do, that's one. And two, even if it can be done successfully, it will not bring down prices because a lot of other consideration has already put in place as a result of that. So we have to be very, very clear when it comes to the topic of minimum wage.
Now, Brian, you know that target of 1,500 by Pakatan Raya, because it's about a monthly wage. Now, Rosli says that instead of just thinking about monthly wages, they should also think about minimum hourly wages.
If we were to talk about this topic in a more realistic and sensible sense, we should talk about the hourly minimum wage. Because if employer were to address the minimum hourly wage, then the earning capacity is up to the employees, you know, rather than employer. If it's just monthly wage, then an employee is going to be tied down to one employer, and then that's the minimum wage that is going to be set by the employer. But if it's hourly minimum wage, then it means that employees can be compensated based on the exact hour they work, and they can be fairly compensated when they are required to work outside working hours, for example. But I think more importantly, the issue of hourly minimum wage makes it easier for us to measure the gap between productivity and compensation. So if employees are being compensated based on monthly, so whether or not they work more or less, they're going to be paid the same. But as far as hourly wage is concerned, so if they were to work more based on hourly wage, then they will be compensated based on the exact time that they work. As we move towards a more advanced / sophisticated policy as far as wages are concerned, this is one area that we can focus in rather than talking about the amount of minimum wage that the government should set moving forward.
That was Firdaus Rosli, Director of Economics, Trade and Regional Integration from ISIS Malaysia, the Institute of Strategic and International Studies, not to be mistaken for the terrorist outfit that's wreaking havoc in many parts of the world. Okay, so the minimum wage before us. Brian, when people talk about this, I ask myself, in a country where you have full employment, where Malaysians are largely employed and we have a huge foreign workforce. What has happened to the ability for Malaysian workers to negotiate a better wage for themselves? When you think that they would have, in fact, the advantage in a situation of, you know, full employment.
So, Sharad, I think that the power balance in terms of the negotiations is in favour of employers, especially at the lower end of the market.
And is that also because, in many ways, the foreign workers have come in, in a way, or have been brought in by employers, and they're the kind of trump card that employers have against local workers. They say, well, you know, if you don't like to work here, no problem. I can always get a foreign worker, and I can pay them, you know, at whatever wage rate that they agree to. Yeah. I mean, there's a question of negotiation, isn't there, when it comes to wages?
I think at that lower level there isn't, and you're spot on about the pressure on wages downward because of the element of foreign workers. It's not just Malaysia, it's a Singapore case as well. At the lower end of the market, there's real pressure on wages because of foreign workers.
Right, so if we have a minimum wage policy, shouldn't it also be set for those foreign workers? And so that...
It should be across the board.
It should be across
the
board.
And the thing is, I think where I believe in a minimum wage policy, but where I differ potentially with Pakatan Rakyat's proposal, for example, is if you increase it dramatically, which is what Firdaus alludes to.
Yeah, because we're talking about a revision, aren't we?
Absolutely. I think if you dramatically increase that wage, you are going to have nasty after effects. However, if you phase in an increase, then employers have time to adjust, wages have time to adjust, prices have time to adjust.
Okay. Taking us all the way to the top of the hour, Crowded House, and Don't Dream It's Over. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Brian Fernandez. Now, it's coming up to 7 minutes past seven on the 3rd of November. We begin with the story of that recent revelation of a massive data breach. It set up concerns about the vulnerability of our personal data. As the scale and the frequency of hacking attacks and data breaches increases, governments and corporations around the world are under intense pressure to shore up their cybersecurity. Not long ago, we spoke to Natalia Yanova Kabarskaya, president of InfoWatch, which looks at information security threats. InfoWatch is a spin-off from the antivirus provider Kaspersky Lab, which Natalia co-founded. Here's Joyce Goh in conversation with her.
I noticed that you have done a survey, and there's some information from that survey that shows that leaks in corporates come from 50% of employees. Could you comment on that? Like, what are the findings on data leaks when it comes to corporations?
InfoWatch regularly makes reports about data leakage on the global scale. How we do it? We find out the cases which went public. We have about 10,000 records. We started to do this job back in 2007. Mm-hmm. So we do it for almost 10 years. Mm-hmm. And we do it twice a year on the global scale. This time we did it also for Southeast Asia. And we see, you know, what we managed to get is like about maybe 1% of the total data leaks what happened worldwide. But it presents an idea which channel of information leaks, who is leaking the information within the company or outside of the company, mm-hmm. what type of data leaks. Is it personal data? Is it other type like trade secrets? Majority of data leaking is, for example, personal data.
And it looks like 51% of leaks for corporations come from employees?
Yeah, internal leak.
Right.
It is very important because that's the type of threat which is very much underestimated.
So
people always think the threat is coming from outside, but it is not only the case.
I see. So how does a corporate secure themselves from that?
For example, in Malaysia, there is a regulatory act for personal data protection, and it prescribes the companies to have some kind of protection, some kind of prevention software, like, for example, data leakage prevention software. That's a special kind of software. Unfortunately, what we discovered here, many companies install this type of the software, but they don't really use it or don't know how to use it. Unfortunately, many companies think that they can only install the software and it will do the job automatically, which is not the case. Because the main secret in the data leakage is that if the software doesn't know what to monitor or what to catch, it catches nothing. it simply will not understand what to catch.
So what is the current information and cybersecurity threat here in Malaysia?
Well, in Malaysia, Malaysia is actually very advanced in terms of IT. And when we made our survey, for example, I found very interesting news about Malaysia that on some extent it correlates to the global statistics. For example, most of data leaking is personal data globally, and in Malaysia is even more, but not very big difference, same. But when we speak about information channel, which channels the information leaks, then in Malaysia they are different. The biggest channel of data leak in Malaysia, cloud. It means that people actually use cloud very much.
So the cloud is not safe?
The cloud is not safe, of course. Forget about safety in the cloud. It's either cloud or safety. There's a two contradictory thing. Because you put information somehow, you don't know how would it be stored, who will be taking care of it, and whatever. And it's the major cases. Another thing is that worldwide, on the global scale, about 4% leaks through removable media. It means that people almost don't use computers. They use tablets, they use mobile phones, they use something. So they jumped over one stage. Mm-hmm. And therefore, such a leakage channel does exist. Unfortunately, when we're speaking about new IT constantly brings new threats. Mm-hmm. And the protection for the new IT is coming always, is always one step behind.
Right.
When we're talking, for example, about things like Internet of Things, then there are so many different devices, different type of Internet things connected, that simply most of them are not protected at all. They do not even have any protection. And that represents huge threat.
So the channel of leaks doesn't come from corporations? Like when we put our personal data with corporations, does the channel of leaks come from corporations as well? For example, let's say I'm applying for a loan with a bank. I give them all my information. Will perhaps my data with the bank leak out?
And very, very many cases.
It's likely?
Yes, very many cases.
How does that happen?
The most probable scenario is that the manager of the bank himself just taking the database together with him.
Right.
When he leaves the company, goes to the to another competitive bank, he comes very often with the database of the clients.
I see.
And then they try to call you and convince that this new bank is better than the previous.
Right. So you see that happening in Malaysia as well, and in the region, it's quite common.
Well, I don't know exactly what type of the leakages has happened here, but I suppose because it's a very generic scenario.
That was Natalia Kapaskaya, president of InfoWatch, speaking to Joyce Goh. Because this is a really important issue, we've had the story of that data breach of millions, literally tens of millions of Malaysians having their data now sold to parties, perhaps who want to target us for advertising, which would be probably the most benign sort of targeting they could be. Because the other possibility, of course, is to somehow worm their way into more personal private data and get at things that we don't want them to get
at. And Sharad, particularly, what concerns me is all the financial scams that they could run because they are in control of this sort of data. Now, the data that's been stolen is not only from the telcos, but really it's also medical data as well. And what Natalia talks about is really how security breaches really, we always think of threats coming from external threats. The reality of what she says is most of the threats are actually from internal threats. So that's an interesting perspective, really, that changes a lot of perceptions.
Do you think that news like this gets you concerned about a more cautious about doing trading online or doing your banking online? Would it deter you, or would you think, well, this is just the way things are now, and you just carry on? I mean, would something like this actually change your behavior?
I think now, just in society in general, for the masses, I think it's not going to change a lot of behavior. A few people will decide to take a step back. But the reality is this. Online transactions and all are the future and they are here to stay.
So you wouldn't head to the hills?
No, I wouldn't, but I'd be a lot more careful. So what you would do is, one of the things I do, for example, is I restrict trading to one card, for example. So I only use one, so you can isolate that problem. All the other cards are not online. That information is not online. Phone number as well. Certain emails. Change your passwords. change your SIM card now because you've had... So these are a couple of things that
you can
do.
Do you think most of us just say to ourselves, it's not going to happen to me. It's, you know, it might happen to somebody else, but it's unlikely to happen to me. I'm not going to be a victim of identity theft. You know, God forbid.
Well, with this latest breach, everyone's affected. It's 46 million records or something like that. So that's more than the entire population of Malaysia.
Right. So the chances are you've been affected by this. Do something about it.
Absolutely.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more news and analysis. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.